He was coming home earlier and he was falling in love with her again, and then she stopped coming to see the counsellor. And so she had to ring her up and said, "What's happened?" He said, "Oh, he's fallen in love with me again." "Great, time to get divorced." "Oh no, it's so nice." And that's brilliant psychology. She taught her, the counsellor taught her actually how to win back her husband. The reason why he was playing around with someone else was because the wife actually wasn't being really heedful about, you know, trying to be attracted to her husband. And he also fed the babies as well. So there's actually sometimes something you can do. But if there is these people who actually like that, and sometimes there's nothing much you can do if they really, really, really are bad, but you can actually tell them, if there's any people here who play around like that, the bad karma of adultery is very, very hard to bear. It really hurts, because anyone who's had someone cheat on you, you know that's a dagger to the heart. That's torture, emotional torture. If that's what you do to others, that will come back on you. But all karma is like that. If you could remember past lives, if you could know the law of karma, any good monk who knows these things would agree, of all the five precepts, that's probably the worst one to break. It's the easiest one to break, but the worst consequences. So don't do that. Have trust. Look after your partner, so you can look after your family. Don't break up the family and give the kids such a hard time growing up. Children, they need a mummy and a daddy, not just one. So keep the family together.
Thank you for that. Switching gears, what if someone has insecurity about the religion they choose, especially when they have friends who said, "Oh, you know, you can't, you know, become a Buddhist, you'll go to hell." So what would you say to people like that?
Well, look, if that is true, then I'm going down there, so you'll be with good friends. This is a story which I heard a long time ago. I know the Buddhists might get offended by this, but I think you're good enough. You understand what I'm talking about here. It's only a metaphor. It's not a true story. But it's an old story that a long time ago, there was a Christian priest on a Sunday gave his sermon, and he said just that. He said that according to our religion, just only Christians, people who believe in Jesus Christ, go to heaven. Everyone else, everyone goes to hell. And in his sermon that day, there was a professor from the local university. And he did what you don't ever do in a Christian service. We do it here in Buddhist services. He stood up after the sermon and said, "May I ask a question?" And the priest didn't have any choice. He's a professor, an important person. He said, "Even though it's not done, okay, what's your question?" And he said, "Listen, you just said that only someone who believes in Jesus goes to heaven. It's been well known in history there have been many wise, compassionate people. The Buddha is one of them. You've got people like Gandhi, wasn't a Christian. People like Marcus Aurelius, Socrates. Where do all these people go?" And the priest had at least enough good sense. "Well, that's a big question. I'll tell it to you next week." He played for time. So usually on a Monday, the priests have a day off because they work hard on Sunday. That's their holiday time. So he had a good rest on Monday. On Tuesday, he went into his library to try and figure out an answer. But he looked in all the books and he couldn't get an answer which was satisfactory, because it didn't make sense. There had been these great people, you know, the Buddha, Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Emperor, Socrates, Gandhi. These were great people, they weren't Christians. What happens to them? So he couldn't find a good answer, so he rang one of his friends, another priest who was a bit older than him, and said, "This is my question, can I come and talk to you about it tomorrow?" So he went to this priest, you know, on the Wednesday. And the priest said, "Look, that's too hard for me. Go and see the bishop." So he saw the bishop on Thursday. The bishop said, "That's too difficult. Go and see the archbishop." The archbishop said, "No, you need to see the theologian." So on a Saturday, he went to see the theologian. The theologian, he gave an answer, but he couldn't understand a word of what it meant. So by Saturday night, he didn't have any answer. And he worried himself silly all night, trying to think, what am I going to say? And not sleeping all night, he got up early. And he thought, the only thing I can do is go into the church and pray for some divine inspiration. So he went to the altar and started praying. It's probably because he hadn't slept all night that he soon fell asleep. And as soon as he fell asleep, he had a dream. He dreamt he was at a train station, and there was a train on the platform. And straight away, his intuition said, I think I know where that train is going to. He asked one of the guards, he said, that train wouldn't be going to heaven, would it? It's a dream. And the guard said, yes. Seeing as you are a religious person, you can go up there for free. So he got on the train, and in his dream, it only took a short time before the train pulled into another station. And on the side of the station was written the letters H-E-A-V-E-N. It was heaven. So he got outside, went outside the train, and he went to the first person he could see, who was wearing these white robes, had a little ring like a donut above his head. And he said, excuse me, sir, what's this place called? Just to make sure. He said, this is heaven, welcome. Oh, great. Now, before I ask this question, it's a very important question. First of all, how long have you been here? Well, he said, I've been up here for a long time, a couple of thousand years, said this angel. Great. Do you know most people up here? Oh, yeah, most of, maybe some of the newcomers I haven't met yet, but I know a lot of people. Is there anyone up here called by the name of Buddha? And the man said, no. What about Socrates, Greek guy? No. Marcus Aurelius? Haven't heard that name. Gandhi? No. And the priest felt vindicated. Yes, I've got my answer. So he went back onto the station to get the train back to Earth, and just thinking so self-satisfied. But when he went to the station, he noticed another train on one of the other platforms. And again, intuitively, he knew where that train was going. So he went to the guard and said, that train over there, would it be going to hell? He said, actually it is. So he bought a return ticket. Got on the train, and in a short while, he arrived in this new station, and on the platform, like all platforms, said H-E-L-L. And underneath was scrawled, welcome. And the welcome was a bit strange, but he got out, and he didn't need to go and find anybody. This fellow came to see him and said, welcome, how are you? Anything I can get you to eat, to drink? He said, look, hang on a bit. Now, hang on with this hospitality business. I want to ask you a question first of all. Is this hell? He said, yes, it's hell. Welcome. Are you sure I can't get you something to do? Where have you come from? From Singapore? Can I get you some noodles? He said, now, this is really strange, because this is not what I thought hell was like. But look, have you been here for a long time? Oh, I've been here for thousands of years. You know everybody? Oh, yeah. We're just so friendly down here in hell. I know everybody. Now, this is strange, but this list of people, are these people down here? Is the Buddha down? Oh, such a wise and compassionate person. Always one of my best friends down here. What about Socrates? Oh, such a great philosopher, such a wonderful mind. Marcus Aurelius? Oh, so profound, writes great poetry. What about Gandhi? Oh, the little black guy. He's tremendous. He said, now listen, I'm confused. I thought I had my answer. According to my religion, all these people should be down here, but this should be a place of torment, a place of torture and pain. And the fellow who was talking to him rolled his eyes. I always said, yeah, it used to be like that before the Buddha came down here. Socrates, Marcus Aurelius. Now, I'm not saying the Buddha gets reborn in hell or anything, but the point of the story is, it's the people who make the place, not the place who make the people. so if all these wonderful Buddhists and Hindus and non-believers went down to hell, it would be a great place. And all these stuck-up evangelical, sort of always getting in your ear and up your back, in the back of your neck. I was going to say somewhere else in the anatomy, but I'm not going to say it. Oh, who would want to go there? It would be a terrible place. So the point is the people make the place, not the place make the people. So that's the answer to the question. Go on. Of course, now the real answer to the question is that's a lot of hocus pocus. A good person goes to good places. That's a very simple way of looking at it, but it is true. Whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Muslim, if you're a kind, generous, now what everyone notices is a good person. Of course, you'll either get reborn in heaven or back on this human earth in a good life. It's not about what you call yourself, a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim, whatever. It's what type of Christian you are. What type of Buddhist you are, what type of Muslim you are, what type of Hindu you are, what type of Jew you are, even what type of atheist you are. And I say that, my father was an atheist. When I talked to him about religion, he said, I cannot believe in a God. And I said, why? He said, because I was actually in Liverpool during the Second World War. I saw so much pain and suffering, I can never again, from what I've seen with my own eyes, believe in a compassionate God. I respected that. You know, it was his rational decision based on his experience. But he was such a kind, loving and caring father. I know that at least one atheist hasn't gone to hell. A person like that can only go one place.
How would you advise someone who has been growing up fearing God and then to be told that perhaps there isn't a God? I mean, how do you get over the insecurity of...
Look, if there is a God, would a God be someone you're afraid of? Look, now I'm just a monk. Are you afraid of me? If you are, I'm doing a very bad job. You're supposed to be compassionate and kind. I remember going to see this monk once. His name was Ajahn Tate, a famous Thai monk. He was an arahat, fully enlightened. I can say that. He also had great psychic powers as well. When I first went to see him, I was told he can read your mind very easily. That made me very afraid. My mind was not ready to be read yet. But it was too late. I went to see him in trepidation. But as soon as I walked into the room where he was staying, all my fear just completely vanished. There, sitting in the corner, this famous monk, so humble, so peaceful, so compassionate, that when you meet someone like that, you just want to sit at his feet for the rest of your life. You feel the safest you've ever felt in your life. You realize that that person never in any which way would harm or hurt you at all. You know that sometimes you might have a grandfather you love dearly who doesn't punish you or doesn't scold you, even if you do wrong things. All he's got is unconditional love for you, care for you. If you multiply that 100 times, that's what it's like being around an arahat. There's no way that they would ever, ever hurt you at all, and you know that. That's how I felt. If there's a God, isn't it going to be something like that? Caring, compassionate, kind. To make the point to people who believe in a God, my mum once thought up this scenario. I try to find, like in Western culture, it's also Singapore culture, who was the most evil, bad, rotten person in the world? At that time, the person which came to my mind was Adolf Hitler, because of how many people he killed, tortured in the concentration camps. Not just Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, many people he killed. You may have other candidates for that post, but I thought, if there was a God, what would happen to Adolf Hitler when he died? And I can imagine this symbol of evil, if you like, meeting the symbol of absolute love. What would happen in that encounter? And I pictured like Adolf Hitler with his little moustache, just quivering with fear when it comes close to the immense power of absolute compassion. Fearing ever the bad he'd done, or the terrible hurt and pain and tears he'd caused, and coming up in front of ultimate compassion. What would happen? I could see like God looking at him sternly in the eye, and then giving him this broad smile and grin. And in that grin and that love, all the fear, even all the guilt of even the Hitler, or Pol Pot, or an Osama bin Laden, melting completely, just as I melted when I saw a monk like Ajahn Tate. And I can imagine that God putting his hands around Adolf Hitler, hugging him and saying, "Adolf, the door of my heart is open to you as well, no matter what you've ever done. Come in, but you're going to have to shave off that moustache. Change your hairstyle, because there's some people in here who just might not understand." But of course they'd let them in. They may not tell you when you're down on earth, but if there's a God, everyone goes to heaven. Because of the power of love and compassion and forgiveness, my goodness. Even as a monk, everybody can be my friend. Even a rapist, even the torturous, I forgive anybody. So what compassion does, you just, you know, sometimes you should get angry at somebody, but I just can't do it anymore. Sometimes monks in my monastery do stupid things, and they come up and I'm supposed to punish them, not punish them, to scold them. I just can't do it anymore. I'm hopeless for that. I was like, go away, just don't do it again, that's all. How can you scold anybody when you've got compassion? You just look at them and smile and melt their pain, and they never want to do it again. It's the end of it. So real compassion, if there is a God, they'll let everybody, Christians, atheists, anybody, because love means the door of my heart is open no matter what or who you are. It's unconditional love. How can a God have conditional love? I love you if you are a Christian, I hate you if you ate. Stupid. Yeah, go on.
Compassion refers to
willing
wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, compassion with wisdom and compassion without wisdom, indeed. But like compassion with wisdom is very much the unconditional compassion, because you find that that heals and helps. But it has to be real compassion of like saying, look, I will not control you. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I'm going to be your friend. So the trouble is, when compassion is not wisdom, we tell people what to do. We make decisions for them. This is in your best interest. The story which came up in my book, which emphasizes this very clearly, was this young boy who was born deaf. And because he was born deaf, he had to go and see the doctor every 6 months or so to see if there's anything they could do. He went once, he was only about 10 or 11 years of age, and the doctor told the parents, just read in the medical journal, there's a new procedure. In 10% of children born without hearing, it could restore their hearing in a very simple procedure. Do you want to give it a try? And the parents said, yeah, why not? Give it a try. So the child had this operation, and he was one of those 10%. His hearing was restored. And he was so upset at his parents and his doctor. He said, why didn't you ask me, first of all, if I wanted my hearing restored? I don't want this noise. He said, I could actually see and hear with my hands much more than with my ears. The point of the story and why I wrote it in my book, because at the time I thought everybody wanted to hear. It's not true. So sometimes we're being kind, we think, oh, people need a new house, or they need a movie, a new TV. It's compassionate to go and take electricity into the poor areas. Do they really want that? Western countries have been worse of all. Out of compassion, they sort of tried to civilize other countries, and they took away so much, many cultures. It was culturally insensitive. They had a good motive. It was compassionate, but they didn't know how to help. They created so much problems as a result. So it's true, I agree, compassion without wisdom creates a lot of mischief. That's why, you know, sometimes you may have some friends who are, you know, fundamentalists. Compassionate, they want to try and convert you because they think it's in your interest, but they've got no wisdom. They have got compassion, yeah, but no wisdom. They create a lot of misery. Especially some of these jokers who go around trying to convert you on your deathbed. Stupid. But look, this is what you should do. If that happens to you, and these Christians come along, maybe a friend in your office, and try and convert you on your deathbed, this is what you should do. When they come in, listen to them for 5 minutes and say, yes, you're right, I convert, I'll be a Christian. And as soon as they're out of the room, convert back to being a Buddhist. You can convert one way, you can convert the other way as well. And the point is, it gets rid of them. Because they won't leave you alone until you convert. So, okay, I convert out of compassion for you. Now you've gone out the door, I convert back again. Just to get rid of them, that's all.
This is a question from one of the audience. Is rebirth definite? And if so, can we choose not to be reborn?
Is rebirth definite? Can you choose not to be reborn? Is paying taxes definite? Can you choose not to pay taxes? You get a big challenge. You just can't do that. So it's not a matter of choice. You have to make all the conditions so you don't get reborn. So it's like, I want to go to Perth. I want to go to Perth to see Ajahn Brahm's monastery. That's not good enough just to say, I want to go. You've got to get an airline ticket and a visa and a passport and a place to stay. You've got to get all the causes in mind. So those of you who want to end rebirth, you've got to get all the causes. You've got to get sila, your virtue, meditation and wisdom, all in order. Otherwise, you'll never pass the security gate into Nibbana.
I've read books mention that we all have guides with us all our lives, and sometimes our guide is a loved one who has passed away, for example, a grandmother. If that is true, why then does this grandmother not get reborn after 49 days?
Yeah. Okay, remember, you can get guides, but sometimes the guides aren't very wise. So sometimes they tend to do stupid things. It's not very wise at all. Now, what actually is that sometimes, imagine if it was you and you died. These are not ghosts. Sometimes people get reborn in the heaven realms. If you get reborn in the heaven realms, you know, most of the time you're enjoying heavenly pleasures. But now and again you've still got like a connection, you know, with your loved ones or with people you're associated with. And sometimes it happens if somebody's in trouble. Sometimes in the heaven realms, you know, your relations know that, they feel that, and they come down and give a hand. It has happened. You know that story of, the best Deva story I can ever say, about the young man who wanted to become a monk in Bangkok? When was the last time I told that story? Put your hands up if you heard the story of the Deva who helped the monk go into the main monastery in Bangkok. Anyone?
I think they've all forgotten.
Okay, yeah. This is it's a great story because there's an American monk, he's still a monk. I don't like to say the name because he's still alive, because it's a very... No, it's actually a very powerful story. But it's true. he was working for the Peace Corps in Thailand. After finishing his, I don't know, 1 or 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, you know, he had an interest in Buddhism. You know, he studied a little bit, and so he wanted to become a monk. But he didn't know, how do you become a monk? So he was staying in a hotel in Bangkok. He asked the concierge. It's not the usual thing which you ask a concierge in the hotel, but he asked the concierge, look, I want to become a monk, how do you do this? And even the concierge didn't really know, but he said, look, there is one of the monasteries, the main monasteries in Bangkok, called Wat Bawon, if anyone knows that monastery. He said, sometimes these Western monks stay there, I've seen them. So all you should do is you go to Wat Bawon. Now the usual way is actually go there early in the morning, take a little bit of food, and then when the monks come out for their alms round, put some food into the oldest monk you can see, and then ask him, now I want to be a monk, please help, basically. That's all the advice he gave. So he got some food, he got a taxi early in the morning, and dropped him off in Bang Lam Phu, which is the area where Wat Bawon is. Unfortunately, his timing was all wrong. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, everything was closed, the streets were deserted, there was no one even to ask for directions, and worse, the monastery was locked. So he wandered backwards and forwards across up and down the road until, not knowing what to do, he saw a man approach him, solitary figure. And the man addressed him in perfect English, now, hello, what are you doing this time in the morning? And the American explained, look, I want to become a monk. I asked the hotel, they said I should wait until the monks come out on alms round. I got some food for them, then I put the food in a bowl and asked them to become a monk. And the man said, listen, it's far too early. The monks won't be coming out until over an hour's time. But never mind. He said, I've got the key to the gate. I can let you inside. And while we're waiting, I'll actually show you around the main hall, the place, the Holy of Holies in Wat Bawon, where the King of Thailand was ordained, where the princes are ordained, because this is one of the main monasteries. At the time, the abbot is now the present Sangharaja of Thailand, the head monk. So, he opened the gate, he took him inside, closed the gate, took him into the main hall, opened the door of the main hall, turned on electric lights, and then he gave him this amazing tour around the hall, because on the halls of the monastery temples in Bangkok, especially the royal temples, are murals. And those murals have scenes from either the time of the Buddha or sometimes the Jataka tales. And this guide was a mine of information, a gold mine of information. And it was fascinating, not just actually what those paintings meant, but actually who were the people who sponsored those paintings and why. Maybe because somebody died in their family or because they were getting married and wanting good luck. And he explained everything about this temple, the royal temple in Wat Bawon. And when he'd finished, he said, the time is almost up now, in a few minutes, the monks will be coming out on alms round. Now if you wait over there, there's a senior monk who usually comes out at this time, he can speak some English, he's the one you should put food in the bowl of, and he'll actually help you ordain. Thanks so much. And the man said, I'll lock up, you go and stand over there. He went to stand over there, just as he was told, in a few minutes, someone came out, he put food in a bowl of this monk, and asked, can I be ordained? He said, oh yeah, come inside. He took him and started training him. After a few days, this Westerner, this American, started complaining. He said, look, the monk you've assigned to me, his English is terrible. Sometimes I can't understand what he means, so I don't know what to do to become a monk. Can you give me somebody else? And the translator sort of translated to the monks, and the monk said, look, of all the monks in this monastery, he speaks the best English. He said, well, look, what about that temple attendant I met the first day? He spoke absolutely perfect English. And they said, what temple attendant? The one who let me in through that gate and took me into the hall. No layperson's got a key to that gate. Those of you who know that gate is opposite the bookstore, the Mahamukkuk bookstore. The only person allowed through that gate is the King of Thailand. It's kept locked for all other people. No lay person's got the key to that temple. Only about two monks have got the main key. Where did you stay you turn the lights on? That's not what the switch is. They immediately dragged this Western monk, or this Western candidate rather, to see the abbot. At that time, Somdet Jana Sangwara, now the Sangharaja of Thailand. He started repeating his story. The abbot, the Somdet, interrupted him. Stop. He called his secretary, take this down, write it down. Because it's true, only the king of Thailand goes through that gate, and no lay person's got the key to that gate. Number two, you can't turn on the lights there. No one's got the key except a couple of monks, the main hall, the Holy of Holies in this temple. And when he started describing what these pictures, these frescoes meant and who actually sponsored them, not even the abbot knew all those details. It was a revelation. And when the abbot asked, who was that person? Describe him. He said he was wearing this old style Thai dress. A man. And then when he was trying to describe this person, he looked around on the wall. Him. He saw his picture on the wall. It was King Rama V, an old king of Thailand, one of the main sponsors of that temple. It's a true story. It's actually written down in the Wat Pho Won. I've met that monk, it's true. An old king of Thailand, born as a Deva, just like in the time of the Buddha, had seen a young man wanting to become a monk, and it opened doors which you can't open, turned on lights without electricity, explained things which only a person at that time would know. The king of Thailand, many, many years ago, had helped a Westerner become a monk. Now that is a guide, a Deva, who still comes down to help people do good things. That's real guides.
Thank you. How many of you got goose pimples? It's a great story.
Yeah.
Thailand has produced many great monks like Ajahn Tate and Ajahn Chah, and many amulets have been produced allegedly by them to provide security. Do you produce such amulets? And are they real?
Now, one day, many years ago, someone went, Ajahn Chah would never produce amulets, not in his lifetime. One day someone went to see him. It was a supporter. They'd just been drafted into the Thai army. Even though there's not supposed to be wars on the borders, there are always skirmishes. They're never reported for security reasons. It was dangerous. So he said, Ajahn Chah, can I have an amulet? Or at least a little Buddha I can wear around my neck to protect me from bullets. And they said, no, look, we don't do that. He said, please, I'm a supporter. Please give me something to protect me from bullets. They said, no, you can't do that. And he argued and argued, and so Ajahn Chah eventually gave in. It's the only time he's given someone a protection against bullets. He said, there's only one Buddha in this whole temple you can wear around your neck which will protect you from bullets. It's a big main Buddha statue in the temple. Wear that around your neck. Ajahn Chah was a joker. Wear the big Buddha statue, like that one there. That's guaranteed. I read in a paper, in Australia even, there was a Thai general about 2 or 3 years ago, had one of these amulets. Now you may know that some of these amulets are worth hundreds of thousands of American dollars, if not a million. Because these are specially empowered amulets, and they've got their pedigree. People have actually worn them and shown they actually work, so they said. And so he bought this amulet for I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars. He was in the officer's mess somewhere in Thailand with his major, boasting about this medallion he had. That I paid a huge amount of money for this, protects you against bullets. Now they've been drinking whiskey, which was part of the problem. And so he said, here to the major, take my gun, shoot me, on order. I'm going to prove this amulet works. So the major had to follow the order. So he took out the general's gun, aimed at him, shot him, and killed him. That's why it's in the newspaper in the West. And that was the story. The amulet didn't work at all. Be careful of amulets. It's not the amulets which work. It's the precepts which work. So I give you the five-pronged amulet to protect you against all bad luck. It's called Parnati Pata Veramani Sikapadang Samadhi Ami Adinadana. The five precepts. That, if you wear that around your heart, in other words, your virtue, your goodness, that is your security. That will protect you from bullets, not pieces of metal, pieces of goodness and kindness. So those are the only amulets which I give out. The five-pronged amulet called the five precepts. It's invisible, you cannot see it. And it's worth more than hundreds of thousands of dollars. Virtue is priceless. So that's the amulets which I give out.
If you're not sure what the five precepts are, please pick up the book, What's Buddhism, written by Ajahn Brahm. Okay, the next question, we're going to have to keep it short now because we've got a few questions here. Is accumulating karma, credit, considered as a purposeful act of self-interest? Is it then the way of Buddhism?
Okay, yep. It's in your interest to come to talks like this. It's in other people's interests. It's just actually knowing cause and effect. In a sense, the more selfless you are, the better karma it is. So if you're doing a karma, you know, when you give a donation to an Ung Pao, but you don't, you say, Ajahn Brahm, you come up here and said, I am making a big donation to your monastery. See, everybody? Now, of course, that is not as much good karma as you do it just humbly. That's why many people like to donate coins in the donation box, because it makes more noise.
Okay, next question, please.
Okay, go on.
Hi, Ajahn. Okay. Earlier you mentioned that as Buddhists, it's great to like lead a simple life, yeah, with very little. Can you hear me? Earlier you mentioned that being Buddhist, it's good to lead a simple life.
Yeah.
Okay. My question is, how do you reconcile between these two, like, or rather, which is a better lifestyle? Is it better to, like, stick to a well-paid job that requires you to work, like, for hours, okay, without much time for any other things? Or is it better to, like, settle for, or like what you said earlier, retire early, and perhaps have lots of time for other things like practice? Thank you.
Okay, you're asking about simple lifestyle. Sometimes that we have to work very hard, but when you're working very hard, don't think you're working for yourself, and it's not just for the money, it's for the service you're doing to, you know, the society. Even if you're working for like an accountant company, it's still good for the society.
Exactly, because like how do you reconcile between these two? Because like, if you have a well-paid job, you have money for like other things like dana.
Yeah. So it's okay if wealth comes to you. There's nothing wrong with wealth as long as it's fairly earned. In other words, earned without making bad karma. So like Buddhism doesn't mean you have to be poor. It means if you are poor, fine. If you're wealthy, fine. It means you don't have to be wealthy. The thing is, in our society, we think if we're not wealthy, we've failed. If that's the case, I'm the biggest failure of all. But if wealth comes to you, it's a burden, it's a responsibility, it has duties with it. So according to the Buddhist idea of karma, and it makes so much sense to me, If you've been a kind, generous person before in your previous life, you become wealthy in this life. Why? It's because if you know how to use money in a previous life, it's as if you're entrusted with money in this life. Because the purpose of money with wealth is not just to be selfish and enjoy yourself or exert power over others. The purpose of wealth is so, you know, you can have your own happiness, but you can serve others. So you can serve others in charity, in helping society, monasteries, churches, whatever, orphanages, even more than others. If you know how to use that money, I'll give you more, says karma. And so generosity means you get more money. That's what karma is. So if you have a wealthy job, if it happens to you and you enjoy it, if be careful, if you've got a family, especially children, and you haven't got much time for them, look out for that, because sometimes your children need you. They need a mum and dad more than money. It's a story I read, I told this at the NUS camp. A father came home from work, tired and very sort of grumpy. His five-year-old son said, "Daddy, how much do you earn every day?" Did I tell that story here?
Yeah.
I told it here, was it?
No, not here.
Sure. Were you listening?
Oh, was I listening?
Yeah, was that about the how much do you earn an hour? Okay, you heard that. Most of you heard that then. And it's a case that, you know, the boy had to buy an hour of his father's time for 20 bucks. That's so sad. So make sure that you have enough time for your children and for your partner and for your religion or your social work. You have to balance your life. If you're single, you can work harder. Or if you haven't got children yet, you can work more hours. But be careful. Because be rich in time rather than rich in money.
In our daily lives, we see people suffering a lot without any reason, even though they have good karma. Why is that?
Because you don't look deeply enough. If you look deeply enough, you see the reasons why people suffer. Sometimes on the outside you think they're making good karma. When you get to know them, they're not. There's some things they're doing wrong. They don't tell other people, but they're doing them wrong. If you ask really good people, they never suffer. Maybe they suffer the ordinary illnesses, colds and whatever, but they know how to deal with them. And they can be such wonderful people even if they're sick. So the case is, yeah, they have done bad karma there, but because you don't know them intimately enough, you don't know exactly what they've done. Because people don't tell you, you know, the stuff which they've done in the past, the secrets which they have in their hearts. That's why I said that when I went to go see that enlightened monk, I wasn't ready for my mind to be read, because I had many secrets. Things which I'd done when I was a young kid, which I wasn't proud of. I had that bad karma, but I wouldn't go and advertise it to people, like many people.
If I have a dog or cat at home and is seriously ill, and the vet recommends I put her to sleep, am I breaking my first precept?
If you have a cat or a dog or some pet at home and they're very, very sick, should you ask your vet to put them down? If you have an old auntie at home who's very, very sick, should you ask the vet to put them down? What's the difference between a cat and a person? Sometimes, actually, if it's an aunt, you say yes. You let them die. Now the point is that this actually happened some time ago. This friend, he took his Labrador dog, you know these big, huge Labradors? He had a sort of an ear infection, so he took him to the vet, and the vet lifted him up, looked underneath him, round his back, round his front, said, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm going to have to put this dog down." He said, "What? He's only got an ear infection. I've got to put him down, because he's too heavy."
He conned you again. If you have been a Buddhist all your life and when you die your children decide to hold a Christian ceremony for you, what happens to your soul?
Just tell that your friends or your children and say, if that happens, according to Buddhism, you come back as a ghost and we'll haunt you forever for doing that. Now look, the truth of the matter is that it doesn't matter what type of funeral they do. Be a Buddhist, be compassionate, let go. Listen, kids, if you want to do a Christian funeral, that's okay with me, because I'm not going to be there, you know, watching all that rubbish. I'll be off in heaven or reborn by that time. Do whatever you want, if it makes you happy, but don't think that's going to make me go to a Christian heaven. Heaven is for everybody who's good. So you can actually, whatever they want to do, don't make a big deal about it. But actually, I should have actually mentioned an important point about if your animal is very, very sick. Because this happens often in Australia. And my answer, I've got a standard answer now. If you've got an animal, a dog or a cat or someone which is very, very sick, and the vet says it's so sick you should put it down, in other words, kill it, my answer is ask your dog or cat what it wants to do. Now, I actually mean that, because those of you who've got a cat or a dog who's a pet, you know that you can contact that. You can know what that cat wants. You ask the question, you get an answer. You know, sometimes the animals we live with are sometimes as close as our children. You ask your cat and dog, have you had enough? Let the cat or the dog decide. Very often the cat will actually say no. The dog will say, no, I'd rather live. It's in pain, but I don't want to die yet. But there comes a time when you've got a dog in great pain, and the dog actually look in its eyes, you ask that question. You know the dog has had enough. Then if you take it to the vet to euthanasia it or whatever, at least the dog's made the decision, not you. That's actually a practical way of answering that question. Ask the cat, ask the dog first of all. And you'll know when you ask the question what the dog or the cat wants.
Any questions from the floor?
Yeah. Come on, quick.
One question.
John Brown, I want to ask this question. Just now it says that good people never suffer. And if you generate good enough good karma, everywhere you go, there's no need to worry, there's no security. Could you comment on, I subscribe to what you say, but then the truth is, if you take a look at the wars in Iraq, those social workers, Red Cross and so on, they get captured, they get executed. Could you comment on it?
Well, again, there's something that's happened there, why they got executed, because they weren't all saints. Some of the workers there, they did some good karma, they did some bad karma as well in these countries. If you look at like social workers, sometimes they drink alcohol, they can argue with other people, sometimes they're not always have the five precepts in order, they're not always good. Sometimes we don't actually see the full picture. Even if you look at someone like the life of Mahatma Gandhi, sometimes he did some bad things. Or Mother Teresa. Mostly they were wonderful people, but they also did some things which weren't so wonderful. But on the whole, they were tremendous people, but they weren't pure. Because we're not absolutely pure, we always do some bad things that we can get some bad results for. So there's something in there somewhere for why that happened to them.
Well, it could also be the outcome of their previous karma.
Previous karma as well, from previous lives, but usually this life as well. And you see, some people actually get caught by the terrorists and get released. Why do they get released while other people get killed? A lot of times there's something going on there. There's some reason, there's some cause. What I say is that there's no real injustice in the world, there's perceptions of injustice.
Okay. So you could actually get your karma ripened by doing good too?
Yeah. If you do good, you attract good.
Okay, thank you.
I attract all these wonderful people. You're just such nice people. Because I do good, I have a good time and meet all these wonderful people. They're so kind and generous, have good fun. It's great being a monk, because you do good, you only meet good people.
I just want to say that Ajahn Brown, you are exceptional. You give very good talk, but not everybody can be Ajahn Brown.
So why not?
So I want to say that for people who actually started out, there should, like, put it that way, there could be insecurities in life. Like some of them, you talk about, you go everywhere, people helping you. But take a job at, take a look at those markets outside. Some of them are jobless, their families to care for. So these are true insecurities. What do you have for them?
I think it's sometimes if they have lost their job or lost their wife or lost some money, sometimes, you know, it's a bit late. They should have been kinder and more caring and saying, you know, now I've got AIDS. You should have put the condom on before, not after. So, you know, the point is, I think I made the point already.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Susan. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ajambra. Thank you, Angie.
Okay.
All right. Try not to rush off. It is the last evening, and we also like, at the end of it, to ask Ajahn Brahm to help us get a bit more blessing before we all end the talk. But there is one last question, which I thought was a very nice one, which I'll save it. It says here, Dear Ajahn Brahm, after listening to your talks, my spirits become very high, and it's very motivational. I feel as though you are reaching for the stars.
Well,
after a few days, but after a few days, I fall through the clouds and back down to the ground. I'm not finished yet. Such lingering thoughts last about maybe 2 weeks or a month. Then it's gone. How do you encourage me, and what way can I keep my spirits high? Thank you. S-Y, S-J.
The answer is, buy my book.
And the CDs.
And CDs, yeah.
Okay, with that, let's put our hands together and say sadhu 3 times and also clap. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Go on, clap if you want to clap. Give it a good one. Thank you once again, Ajahn Brahm, for your sparkling performances for your last over the last 3 days. And I do apologize for my shortcomings. First day, I know the microphone wasn't working very well. Somebody told me yesterday they couldn't understand me very well, and today I don't know what I've done. So anyway, you know, I'd like to put on record our thanks to the Buddhist Lodge for lending us the use of this place, which is very kind and generous of them. And we hope that the buses have served you well. There will be buses downstairs for you to go to the MRT. So don't rush off. And also, if you haven't got your book autographed, please feel free to queue up. And I'm sure Ajahn Brahm will be very happy to stay back and sign them all for you. So I'd like to now request Ajahn Brahm to give us the blessings for the new year.
Okay, this is not the blessing for this year, the old year, the new year, and every year. Sabba roga vinimuto, sabba santa puvacito, sabba vera mati gando nibuto chatu vangbava, sabitiyo viva chantu sabba roga, Vinasatu mate bhavan vantarayo Sukhi digayu gopava apiva tanhasi litsa Nichang vutta pachalino Chattaro dhamma vatanti Ayu vano sukhang balan.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good.
And may we also take this opportunity to dedicate our merits to your good health, Ajahn Brahm. And may you be able to continue to spread the great Dhamma to more people around the world for their benefit. And may we also commit our path
be guided by the triple gem always, and to walk this path towards attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Sadhu.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, and with that, I'd also like to thank the volunteers for having so kindly come forward to help. And Awareness Place has also come forward to bring some books. Those of you who are interested, please, there are books for children as well as for adults. So with that, I thank you very much, and I hope to see you again next time. May you always be blessed by the Triple Gem.